This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here again with Charles Lincoln for the second part of our show. So, Charles, you're still in Dallas, Texas.
I am indeed.
This show, like, I guess we can kind of break it up by city. So we kind of talked about, though, we talked about the history of houses, and we tied it in with New Orleans. We talked about this is something that affects all cities. I guess I wanted to ask you about some of the major cities. So I wanted to, if we have enough time, we can touch on like New York, LA, San Francisco, Dallas. Oh, in our last show, we did talk about European cities. So you actually lived in London in the 1980s.
Well, I actually lived there in the 1960s, as a matter of fact, and went back in the 1980s, and it had changed, and it's changed even more now. I'm happy to say I haven't lived there since.
Do you remember it in the 1960s?
Well, I mean, I was a little kid, but yeah, I have childhood memories. It wasn't, you're interested in different things when you're a kid, but I'll tell you one thing I remember, there was really no major traffic problem getting around London. By the 1980s, there definitely was. You look at films from the 1920s, and it's almost incredible how empty the streets of London look, or even the streets of New York or Los Angeles, for that matter. They're big open spaces in these big cities, and they weren't chock block full of people. And of course, now they are, and you know. Owning a car in New York these days is almost suicidal. People pay thousands of dollars a month, literally, for parking places in New York. It's the most amazing thing. It's a great place to be a cabbie, I guess. But
LA, totally, with public transportation, really, I mean, it sucks both ways because, like, LA has the traffic. But at the same time, it doesn't have adequate public transportation. I mean, I visited London in 2002, and one thing I was impressed by is you could just get on the underground and just be in another side of the city really quick. That's not something you can do in L.A. But, I mean, I was there in 2002, but it was a really... I was there briefly, but it was a really exciting experience, a really interesting place to visit.
The Muslim invasion had started by then.
It did, but I'm sure it's gotten a lot worse.
Oh, I mean, it clearly has. The latest I read, I don't know if it's true or not, but the latest I read is only 40% of the population of London is Anglo-Saxon.
When I was... I went to a lot of the tourist areas. I mostly went to the tourist areas and some of the other areas. I stayed in an area that was called Vauxhall, which was kind of working class, but it was in the process of being gentrified. But a thing is, like in LA, like you can go if you go on a bus in LA, like you can just go. You can go miles in LA and not see, like, you can only see, like, foreigners. My estimate of being on the underground in London was about 40% of people on it were English, maybe 40 to 50. But I was mostly in the nicer touristy parts.
And you're talking about on the tube. The overall population of the city, I mean, at that point was still, I think by in 2002, there was still a majority Anglo-Saxon in London. In New York, the subway system was largely white through the 1970s and even into the 80s. I don't know if you've ever heard of the Bernard Goetz incident, but
there was a man was, two blacks attacked him and he shot them in self-defense.
Well, they sort of cornered him. They weren't quite attacking him. They made him feel cornered. His description of it was that he felt they were playing cat and mouse with him. It wasn't, I mean, that was part of the reason it was such a controversial case. They didn't actually physically attack him to the point that it was, a black and white case of self-defense. And that's why it became so sensational. But I mean, I remember taking the subway in New York in the early 80s when I was a graduate student at Harvard and went down to New York to see my girlfriend that time. And it was basically interesting because what it was it was a lot of lower class, working class whites on both both the New York subway and the Boston subways.
Yeah, it's interesting because New York has like always been famous for having like a lot of like working class Irish and Italians, and most of those people ended up moving out to the suburbs. That's not the case anymore.
Well, in the last segment we had talked about the results of integration. One place where integration didn't work out nearly the way they expected it to was in South Boston. South Boston was largely Irish in some neighborhoods and black in other neighborhoods. They tried forced integration there. The absolute worst, most violent anti-integration riots in U.S. history took place in Boston, not anywhere in the South, but in Boston in the 1970s. And, you know, the Irish simply did not want it. And basically, you know, the integration up there failed. And to a great extent, the Irish have not moved out. They're still there. And up to a point, the blacks kind of moved out, and they were dispersed into other New England suburbs. And you know, so that's an interesting pattern there. I mean, in terms of architecture, of course, you know, you were talking about how the density of the cities existed in the absence of single-family homes, but the brownstones of Boston and New York started out pretty much as single-family homes, and then they were subdivided, and they became multiple family dwellings over the course of the 20th century, and that pattern still exists in a large part of New York. It's simply unfeasible now for many people to own what's potentially a $10 million brownstone as a single-family home, so they get subdivided.
How would you compare New York today to New York back then? I know a lot of people say that New York had a lot more. New York was definitely rougher, but a lot of people said New York had like more character in the 70s and 80s. Like, what's your take on that whole era of New York City? It's sort of famous for a lot of different films.
Yeah, well, I mean, New York was still, I mean, the overwhelming impression. I have not been in New York this year, 2015. I have not, but I spent like a total of a month there last year, and in 2014, and comparing that with, say, 1980, 82, I was dating a girl at Yale, and we always met in New York. Harvard and Yale person shouldn't be seen on campus together or something, I don't know. Anyhow, we always met in New York. Fun place to meet. And it was a white city. New York was a white city. It was tough white people, but they were white, and the movie American Hustle captured it very well, really. Did you see the movie American Hustle last year, Jennifer Lawrence, Chris Bale?
I haven't seen that yet.
You must. It's what should have won the Oscar, but they gave it to 12 Years a Slave or 7 Years a Slave or 7 Years a Black Duck or whatever it was. and Ellen, of course, told the Academy, you're going to vote for 12 Years a Slave or you're all racist, right? Okay, totally separate story. American Hustle totally should have won the Oscar that year, but it didn't. Anyhow, though, it really captured late 70s, early 80s New York, as did in a movie made at the time, which was Desperately Seeking Susan, with Madonna's first movie.
The film Midnight Cowboy, does that really capture New York at the time?
I got to admit, I've never seen Midnight Cowboy, so I'd have to defer to you. What do you think? Tell me about it if you've seen it. How does it show it?
Oh, it's about John Voight goes there. He's like a young man from Texas, and he goes to New York. He ends up becoming a prostitute, both heterosexual and homosexual.
I guess that's why I didn't see it.
You have to see like the seedy underbelly of New York in the 70s.
Hey, I mean, it was always ahead of the rest of the country as far as, you know, tolerance for gays and, you know, various other, you know, shall we say, alternative lifestyles. You know, women with piercings and tattoos made their first appearance in New York at that time and were quite shocking to a country boy like me, so to speak. But it's interesting. If they were white cities, and now they're dominated by blacks and Muslims. That's my overwhelming impression of New York. Is, you know,
even Manhattan. Manhattan's pretty expensive now.
Last year, I'm talking about Upper East Side. Last year, I was staying in a friend's apartment on in the Upper 80s, Upper East Side. And the part of town that used to be Germantown.
Yorksville.
Exactly. And anyhow, there are very few Germans left. There are almost no Anglo-Saxons left. That part of town is, you know, it's heavily dominated by Pakistanis, Iranians, Ethiopians, and it's really amazing. Whites are very scarce, even in Manhattan. Yeah, and you know, it's a very strange thing. Demographic displacement has taken place. There are not a lot of Italians. Very few Irish, you know, and as far as WASPs go, forget it. I mean, almost none. One of the hilarious things while I was up there in May of last year was that a cab driver, you may have heard the story, a cab driver was arrested for wearing a swastika armband. And
he was the African guy.
He was black from Santo Domingo, from the Dominican Republic.
Oh,
but I mean,
okay.
the news report didn't reveal that at first, and you know, everybody assumed that this guy was, you know, German or white or something, and because he was quoting Mein Kampf and talking about, you know, how the Jews were controlling New York and it had become a horrible place, and, you know, he was opposed to Jewish domination of the world, and I mean, basically he sounded like your stereotypical Nazi. And it turns out he's black as pitch from the Dominican Republic, and his native language is Spanish. I mean, that is typical. He's sort of emblematic of New York. Even the Nazis aren't white there anymore. I mean, when even the Nazis aren't white, you know, something's definitely happened. And, you know, strange to say, Dallas still is one of the whitest places in the United States.
I wanted to ask you more about New York. I mean, what are your... New York definitely has some of the most interesting architecture in the world. You have a lot of the most, like a lot of the best, like Art Deco, and you have like the Chrysler Building. You have like all the railway stations, like Grand Central Station. And then there was the famous one, Pennsylvania Station, which was torn down to build, I think, Madison Square Gardens.
Right. Are you aware that actually, as a percentage of the buildings now standing, Los Angeles has a better preserved Art Deco downtown than New York does?
That wouldn't surprise me. I mean, there's a lot. I mean, even... there's some in Santa Monica, even.
Oh, God. Santa Monica used to have so much more. Now, you were like 9 when the 94 earthquake hit, so you probably don't remember much of what it looked like before. But
I remember
Santa Monica used. But do you remember what Santa Monica looked like before? Santa Monica was all Art Deco. I mean, the 3rd Street Promenade was just like an architectural museum. So was, you know, most of Wilshire in Santa Monica.
You
it was
have
so beautiful.
The Shangri-La Hotel, which I think is like streamlined modern. And then the tallest building in Santa Monica is that Art Deco clock tower.
I guess it is. It hasn't been overbuilt yet, although...
I don't know if it's the tallest, but it's one of the most signature buildings.
Oh, it sure is. I mean, it seems like that hotel on the north side of Wilshire may be taller than it, but I'm not sure. It's multi that I can't remember what is that called. Is that the Fairmont? What's it called? The one right at the corner of Wilshire and Ocean.
Oh, I think it is the Fairmont.
Anyhow, and they're building. I mean, Santa Monica used to be all single family homes. You realize that? In the 70s and even as late as the early 90s before the earthquake, it was almost 100% single family homes, beautiful bungalows. God, it was really like paradise. And now they're building multifamily condos and apartments and almost all those beautiful old bungalows, a lot of Victorian homes still survived. They're all gone, and so much of it was damaged, or they said it was damaged enough in the earthquake to justify tearing it down. I mean, I think that a lot of that was pure opportunism.
I know in Santa Barbara was originally Victorian architecture, and then what happened is in 1920, Santa Barbara was destroyed in an earthquake, and there was a major fire, and then they rebuilt it in Spanish-style architecture. But there's still a handful of older Victorians left in Santa Barbara.
Yeah, it was 1926, wasn't it?
Yeah,
1926. I guess I had a cousin out there who went through that earthquake. My grandfather had taken a trip out west to visit him back then. I don't know whatever happened to that branch of the family. Anyhow. Oh, I guess they moved. I do know they moved up to Monterey. Anyhow, the thing is that it's just the themes are the same over and over again. You get single-family homes dominant all through the early 20th century, and then being replaced or converted, either converted into or replaced by multifamily dwellings. I mean, in New Orleans right now, so many of the beautiful old mansions of the Garden District, especially the Lower Garden District, are being converted into condos. I mean, they were once single-family homes, and now they're being converted into three-plexes and four-plexes, so that you can have a denser population in a city that was meant to be the epitome of, you know, basically high-class individual living. And in Dallas, these areas near where I'm staying right now, they have something totally new that I had never experienced in Dallas before called Uptown, which is, you know, the area between downtown and Highland Park, basically, right where Church of the Incarnation is, where I was a choir boy many long years ago. And that all used to be single-family homes off of the McKinney, Cole, Travis, Haskell, all those streets used to be single-family homes, and they are all almost 100%, maybe 100%, in fact, converted into apartments and condos now. And, you know, that's called gentrification. That isn't it interesting that that's called gentrification, but it really means an overall decline in the standard of living. Gentrification is actually degeneration. It's getting people to think that high density living is somehow higher class because they compare it to New York, and so they start charging.
The thing with like apartments and density is like there's a lot of places that have high density that are really beautiful places that have beautiful architecture. I mean, Paris, San Francisco, parts of New York. I mean, as I said, like the Chrysler Building is a beautiful building and it's really tall. So I don't see
it's not an apartment,
taller.
It's not an apartment building, though. I mean,
no,
the Chrysler
but I don't see like taller structures as bad by themselves. It's just I do think a lot of the apartments going up around LA, they're just really bland. They don't have any character.
Well, character has gone out of most architectural construction, and, you know, it's kind of I'm sure I'll be stepping on some major toes here, but I see a comparison between music and architecture over the course of the 20th century. You know, music used to be very individualistic and an expression of the talent or this particular voice qualities or the philosophy of particular singers, and now it's all about techno, high mass, high consumption, you know, impersonal noise. And I mean, I see both architecture. I see the architecture is the same way. Mass-consumed, fast food type of culture in both, you know, dwelling places and music. It is so disturbing and sad to me that is, you know, Dallas used to be all about individual homes. Los Angeles was about individual homes. And these two cities are just now abandoned to sort of mass culture. And, you know, even though Dallas is one of the whitest cities in the country, it too has, I mean, there used never to be any Arabs or, you know, foreign blacks or Muslims around here. And there are now, and it's so weird. I mean, even little cities like Fresno, it's just so weird how the alien population has just so completely.
Fresno is a good example of a I mean, well, there's, I mean, Fresno's a very ugly city. And the few, and there's like a handful of beautiful older buildings downtown that are totally abandoned. But I mean, Fresno is one of the ugliest cities I've ever visited or spent like time in. I don't really want to talk too much about Fresno. I was recently in San Francisco over the summer, and I guess I don't know if you're how much time you've spent there, but I'd say it's probably the most beautiful American city I've visited. And it's also,
I've spent very little time in San Francisco. I've spent very little time in San Francisco. I've got friends who live over in the Berkeley area and, you know, Palo Alto and Belmont, South Bay area. But when I was a kid, I went to the St. Francis Hotel with my grandparents a couple of times, and I've been to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals a couple of times downtown. But that's about it. That's pretty much the extent of my experience in San Francisco, and my impression of what I've seen is that they too are seeing gentrification rapid increase in values in property and hence subdivision of what used to be single family homes, even in what once were the suburbs of San Francisco, the south suburbs. Of San Francisco, a friend of mine earlier this year was dealing with a real estate situation down in Brussels, which is not in the heart of the city by any stretch of the imagination, but it's an area where values have gone up tremendously, and so there's tremendous pressure to subdivide and not maintain single owner or single occupant housing anymore. And this is in large part because of the vast influx of immigrants. It used to be just Asian immigrants in San Francisco, and now it's the powers that be under Barack Hussein Obama seem to be favoring African and Islamic immigrant. I can't imagine why, but under Barack Hussein Obama, that just seems to be the pattern. Can you think of any reasons why that might be?
Huh. I'll try to think about it, but it's very mysterious. But anyhow,
We have been betrayed, Robert. That's what it is. We have been betrayed and sold out.
The last time I was in San Francisco, I did check out. Well, I did go to the St. Francis the first time, and I got to go up to the view at the top and check things out. But the second time, I went into the lobby, and it's like a hotel, patrons only.
Really? You can't? It's not open to the public at all?
Well, to go up to the view, you can go in the lobby. I mean, as far as, like, architecture goes, I mean, that's one of the most... Probably, I mean, that city probably has the highest concentration of beautiful architecture of any city, like that area. Especially, I mean, even around, like, Union Square, it's a very touristy area, but you still have, like, businesses that have been there a long time. I mean, there's, like, a lot of Art Deco, a lot of buildings that have been there since the earthquake. It feels a little bit like
New York,
but I haven't been to New York, but a lot of people have actually said San Francisco still has more character than New York.
You've never been to New York City?
No.
How'd
the major cities I've been to, I've been to San Francisco, I've been to London, I've been to Las Vegas, I've been to Hawaii, and that's about it.
You ever been to Los Angeles?
Oh, I don't think I have, no.
Well, you should go there sometime. It's close to Santa Barbara. It's actually even close to Brentwood.
Yeah.
Anyhow, no, you should definitely go to New York and Chicago. I mean, we haven't talked too much about Chicago. I think one of the most interesting things about Chicago is Chicago, unlike Los Angeles, unlike New York, unlike New Orleans, unlike Dallas, is this spectacular grid, regular streets going on for miles and miles and miles in a continuous grid. When you're flying into Chicago, it's just amazing. It's how regular and perfect the grid is, extending in a large moon, I guess, crescent moon shaped city from the south shore of Lake southwest shore of Lake Michigan, I should say. And in that sense, Chicago is just, you know, New York has a very limited grid pattern in sort of midtown Manhattan. It's very regular. It's very narrow and confusing streets when you get to the Financial District, Greenwich Village, all that. But once you get up to Central Park and the 40s and mid 50s, it's pretty regular. But because it's an island, it doesn't extend into any of the other boroughs. And then the Los Angeles has grids that more or less work in the absolute worst parts of town, but they're not very much to look at because, you know, interesting thing about Los Angeles's bad areas in the 80s, 90s, and 100s south is how dark it is. But Chicago is this consistently well-lit grid going on for dozens of miles, both in the north-south and east-west axis from Lake Michigan. I was just in Chicago, about 6 weeks ago, and I had forgotten what an amazing experience that was. Chicago probably has the third best public transportation system in the country. The best is probably still New York. Second best is the T in Boston and the L in Chicago. You can go almost anywhere. I mean, what you're saying about London, in New York, Boston, and Chicago, you can pretty much go anywhere in the city, at least in the core areas of the city, very fast on the trains. And in Dallas, they're sort of instituting some pathetically underdeveloped train systems to try to copy that. And Los Angeles
is doing the same thing with the subways.
The LA subway is still just like, you know, it's like the bus line. I mean, they have one line going out west.
Well, I've been on
it.
It's pretty fast, but I lived in the west side, so it wasn't really accessible to me. It goes from downtown to Hollywood, but it is pretty fast. I mean, you can get from downtown to Hollywood in like less than 10 minutes.
Robert, in the early 70s, you could get from downtown to Hollywood in about 10, 15 minutes by car.
I'm sure you could.
These distances
but
are not that great.
I forget. I mean, I haven't been in LA in a long time, so I'm kind of forget how bad the traffic is. I haven't been in a really bad traffic.
It's totally nightmarish. I mean, I like to be in Santa Monica, Brentwood, closer to the water, and my friends Theodore and Amalia, you know, they live in Beverly Hills, and you know, it's like 405 is only slightly less fatal to cross than the River Styx, entrance into hell. I mean, you know, it's one way or the other, no matter which side you consider, you know, hell, of which the realm of the living and the realm of the dead, you know, around 4 to 7 in the, really 3:30 to 7:30, it's like impossible to get from West Los Angeles to Beverly Hills. You know, it's insane what the high density of living has done to the quality of life. And, you know, it's been tending in that way.
Well, the thing about L.A. is it was originally built very much kind of, it was a very suburban city, very car-oriented, but it increased
right.
dramatically in density. So it had the density of a major city, but it lacks the infrastructure of great cities like New York or London.
And, I mean, up to the point, I mean, Dallas is heading in that direction.
I'm looking up Dallas. I've never been to Dallas, but I mean, I'm looking up at a picture of Dallas. And so I see, like, this. It looks kind of cool. I mean, you have this tall tower with this, like, round ball of lights on it. That must have been there a long time.
I don't know. I think it was built in the 80s, some type of reunion tower. I'm pretty sure that's what you're talking about.
And then I see this other tall one with, like, a tall building with, like, green lights on it.
That, too, it dates back to the time when they were making the TV show Dallas in the 80s. But I don't know. I mean, that isn't really emblematic of life in Dallas. Life in Dallas used to be single-family homes everywhere. And, you know, in the past 21 years since I last spent any time here, the big change is that single-family homes are being replaced everywhere by mega apartments and condos, and that means that the quality of life is going to be sacrificed for density. And to what end and to what purpose? Why are we creating these dysfunctional, highly dependent, very vulnerable cities that are basically dependent for their lives on the existence of a police state is what it comes down to? Because, as I say, if anything ever interferes with the modes of distribution of food by truck, these cities will start starving and everyone will start rioting in fairly short order. And I don't understand why they have opted to go in that direction, except to maximize the power of the government and dependency of the people. And that sort of gets back to where I said at the beginning of, you know, our last talk, I feel that the changes in urbanization and in patterns of urban dwelling and the modes of urban architecture, single family to multi-use, it's all part of this incredibly insidious social plan to really destroy the ideal of freedom, which was so essential to early America. And I think we need to, you know, take radical steps to, dare I say, cleanse the population of so many, you know, intruders, foreigners, and we need to start restoring autonomy of living so that, you know, do you realize that on an acre of land, people can support themselves? A family can support itself on an acre of land if they use it well. And there are plenty of acres to support many hundreds of millions of people in the United States. But if you concentrate all the people, you know, sitting in front of computers, in essence doing nothing of any value, kind of like you and I are right now, for instance, you know.
At least we're doing something somewhat intellectually stimulating.
Okay, but we're not producing any food. It isn't going to keep you or me alive.
We were on the topic of L.A., and Charles, you were kind of talking about how cities like Dallas and Houston were removing a lot of the single-family homes and replacing them with larger condos. I want to get your thoughts on what do you think about the whole sort of revitalization of L.A.'s urban core, like downtown L.A. especially?
Well, it's sort of spectacular in a way, although it's I don't quite understand what's going on in Los Angeles. I noticed that my favorite bookstore in Santa Monica is moving to downtown Los Angeles. And
oh,
first
Hennessy and Ingalls, that one.
Yes, you know about it. And basically, they're moving. I mean, it's precisely what we're talking about, because do you realize that they are moving into precisely a large apartment building? They are going to be the ground level floor of a huge apartment complex that is, I think it's a 4 or 5 levels or something like that, but maybe it's higher than that. But anyhow, it's a very large, and it's very long and spread out. So
it's in an area called the Arts District. It's like a former sort of warehouse industrial district that they're redeveloping.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. Downtown LA, it seems to me, was never quite the desert that some towns were, because I mean, even when I was in high school, we were talking about it. They already in the early 70s, they already had the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion and the Mark Taper, the Disney.
Interestingly enough, that area you're mentioning, like Dorothy Chandler Pavilion, that was an urban renewal project that removed the old Victorian mansions from the 1800s.
Well, actually, you're telling me something I didn't know, so that's interesting. I'm terribly sorry to hear that. I mean, it makes sense, of course, but maybe LA was just way ahead of the curve then, because that was an early 70s project. All that shining white construction down there. I mean, Dallas did much the same thing, though. Dallas moved it created a new symphony hall and a museum of modern art, the Morton Myerson Symphony Hall and the Museum of Modern Art, and now the Perot Center, Science Center. It's all in what used to be sort of very grungy parts of downtown, and one of the biggest nightlife areas. There are two really big nightlife areas in Dallas. One is called Deep Ellum, which was in a really terrible section on the northeast edge of downtown, and then they've got the other part called the West End, where they've got Dallas Alley, and that was a big thing in the late 80s and early 90s, and they're up to a point, it's good. It's good to reuse some of this historical architecture, bring it back to life. If they're tearing it down, of course, if they're tearing it down, that's a totally different. And you're saying it sounds like they did some terrible things in Los Angeles to make way for Dorothy Chandler, and that's absolutely too bad. The Amundsen. That whole complex down there, though, is really one of the great areas in the U.S. And I guess Dallas.
Did you work downtown in the 1980s?
I did. I worked 312 North Spring Street, which is still that's a building, of course, that was never abandoned. I mean, that was built in the 1920s or maybe the early 30s. And that was the United States District Court and Ninth Circuit, judges' chambers. It's not nearly as nice as the Pasadena Courthouse. The Pasadena Courthouse is really spectacular, but it's 17 or 18, the 312 North Spring Street, 17 or 18 story building, and the Court of Appeals judges appropriately are right on top on the top of it, and the rest of it is all trial courts, and you know that it's very close to the state courts and the state law library, very close to Stanley Mosque and Ronald Reagan buildings, and that's you know in that sense most downtowns I guess never really died because most of them, including Dallas, had always had the courts downtown and always had a lot of banks downtown, but they didn't have a lot of life. And so, I mean, when they built Dallas Alley and the West End, and when they built Dorothy Chandler and Mark Paper, you know, they were basically trying to create a cultural life in addition to a business and governmental life for downtown. And I basically fundamentally approve of that, but I mean, you know, Hennessy and Ingalls right now, it's still in Santa Monica as of this moment. I think they're moving in February. And, you know, it's a strange thing that gentrification, again, in a sense, of Santa Monica, which basically means that the prices are going through the ceiling, is leading to some very strange economic perversions. Hennessy and Ingalls is going to be replaced by, I assumed it was going to be replaced by a retail store that sort of sold clothes or, you know, other higher price per unit, you know, items than books. Books basically can't be sold on too much of a markup, especially with, you know, the internet these days and Amazon centralizing book sales and things like A-books. But, you know, Hennessy and Ingalls in Santa Monica is going to be replaced by a restaurant. And, you know, it freaked me out when they told me that. Santa Monica is like wall-to-wall restaurants now. And, you know, what does that tell us? About
what's the place we go, the Interactive Cafe? I mean, it's kind of overpriced, but it has a nicer atmosphere than a lot of the chain coffee shops.
Well, sure, the Interactive Cafe over on Broadway, it's nice in a part in a sense because it's dysfunctional. It's almost never crowded. And I don't know how they managed to keep it never crowded, maybe by the high prices or something, because they never have any clientele. Peyton always hated the place because he thought it was so overpriced, but I enjoyed it precisely because you could go in there usually.
I enjoyed it because I didn't mind it because you were paying, but
Well, thank you, Robert. I'm deeply moved by your sentiments and. Also,
thank
by
you.
Your honesty in that regard, and I'll, you know, keep these things in mind. Overall, I think that Literati has a much livelier atmosphere and better value. But
and you know what else it's famous for, Literati?
Corner of Bundy and Wilshire, Brentwood. Attractive young ladies of mixed Caucasian and Semitic ethnicity, as I think you said.
back to the original topic of cities, we were talking about, which your overall premise is that the ideal is to own a single family home. And the thing is about that is I agree with you that the destruction of having people owning single-family homes is a bad thing. I'm just not – at the same time, I'm not against cities. I think visiting big cities that are, like, really dense cities can be exciting experiences. Like I told you when I visited London, visiting cities like New York, San Francisco, I think those are very exciting, dynamic places to visit or to live.
So you're not necessarily anti-urban.
I am not anti-urban at all. I'm not even remotely saying that. I'm saying I like it when cities have a well-defined economic function that does not destroy the independence of the largest part of the population. And I think that part of the problem we're seeing right now is that urban dwelling is really a threat to social cohesion and social integrity. What I was going to say about the connection between multi-dwelling homes and restaurants is that the single-family house was a cohesive social unit, kind of related, at least in part, to the farmhouse, the tradition of the farmhouse. Even a home on a half acre or a quarter acre lot can still have a little garden and a little self-sufficient latency and a very strong sense that it's a complete place for a family to live. A private home, a single family dwelling can have several generations living in it. It can be a center of family activities, and it can be a center of, in particular, eating and, basically family feasts, eating and sharing life together. And I think that it's not at all coincidental that single-family homes are disappearing from Santa Monica at the same time that restaurants are proliferating, because basically you live in a tiny little, even a three-bedroom apartment. I mean, I don't know if you remember Theodore's little apartment in Beverly Hills.
No, I've never visited there.
Oh, you haven't? Okay. Well, anyhow, Theodore, a friend of mine, has really, in some ways, a quite lovely three-bedroom apartment in Beverly Hills that, it has windows on both sides. It has a nice little balcony. But, it's not a home. There's barely enough space for, Theodore and his daughters and one other person to sit down at a table either on the balcony or in their central room, which is also an office and a living room and a dining room. And, in even the smallest single-family home, you would not feel so crowded because you'd have the outside space, you'd have the curtilage of the home. And
well, the thing is with the situation in California is the population is growing because of mass immigration.
And what causes mass immigration is government policy. The government is responsible for inviting these people in, whether they admit it or not. Don't tell me that this immigration is not a government's cum corporate banking policy to depress the standard of living in the United States, increase dependency, and destroy the autonomy of individual families. It clearly is. And you crowd people into an urban setting. They no longer have a home as a center of family continuity and quality of life, the center of family feasts, birthdays, Christmas, Thanksgiving, 4th of July. You can't do those things. You certainly can't have much of a 4th of July celebration in a nice three-bedroom apartment in Beverly Hills because you have no grounds. You have no space in which to light any fireworks. And, of course, they suppress anything like that because the population density is so great. If you send off fireworks, it's not going to, Well, you're not risking setting your own house on fire or your own trees on fire. You're risking setting, fires among people you've never met, literally, who might live two doors down from you, because the population density is that great.
Kind of movement. I'm not sure familiar with it. Called like a new urbanism, and it's about creating like, I guess you could say denser, but kind of walkable communities. The problem is with the whole single family home model that was built in the post-war era. It was totally car oriented. I mean, if you go to European cities, even the smaller cities, they are much more compact. Everything is within walking distance. But I guess you had that with, as you pointed out earlier on, like when people lived in brownstones, they had single-family homes, but communities
sure
were a lot more compact and walkable. But if everything is so spread out like it is in the suburbs, then you basically have to drive everywhere.
Well, again, I mean, compare Cambridge, Mass, and Boston. Boston, of course, the houses are pretty much shoulder to shoulder, as they are in New York. But in Cambridge, around Harvard and MIT, I mean, you've got the old tradition of the 19th century community, the 18th and 19th century community, where everyone had a yard. I mean, I guess it was always a suburb of Boston in some sense, but the English village, the French village model for that matter, is a model of single family homes. And yet you have small communities. I mean, walkability has to do with having communities on a scale where you can walk to a square. I mean, everywhere in Cambridge is totally walkable, but until very recently, it was a city of single-family homes. And so the two are not incompatible. It's some of these gigantic suburbs. I think we briefly mentioned Levittown on Long Island as the prototype mass construction.
That was the very first one.
Yeah, but it was a prototype. I mean, it was a prototype for, like I said, for Plano, Texas, and the San Fernando Valley. And all these tractless, you know, hundreds of square blocks of homes that don't have a center, that don't have a square, that don't have a community focus, and that basically they're designed for people to move in. And the reason they're not walkable is not because they're single-family homes. It's because they're not communities. There are no centers. There are no activity areas except these gigantic malls, which again are anti-community. You know, people, the gigantic malls are the antithesis of the old squares in New England or southern towns.
I think something like, so we were talking about Santa Monica, something like the Third Street Promenade. It's kind of, I mean, it's kind of artificial, but I think it's trying to kind of recreate those, like, original town squares.
That's a fucking failure. I mean, pardon my French. If that's what they're trying to do, it's a fucking failure of the first order. Because
remember that place you went to called The Grove? I took you to that one time.
Sure. I mean, that's the same thing. That's just a regular mall. I mean, there's nothing innovative about that at all. That's just a mall.
I mean, the promenade actually has like older buildings integrated into it. There's still some older buildings in that area.
Well, I mean, very, very, again, very few, because most of them, like I said, you know, you can't possibly remember what Santa Monica was like in the 80s and early 90s when they still had a lot of Art Deco buildings standing, a lot of brick buildings standing. Those all came down in the earthquake of 94, the immediate years thereafter. I think some of that was a scam, that people were just trying to take advantage of the earthquake as an excuse to tear down old buildings and build new ones. I think it was a great tragedy, but You know, I don't know when it was the last time you were at the Clary Street Promenade. I was there a couple of weeks ago.
Last time, I think it was with...
Me and Gonzalo?
Yeah.
Well, that's been a while. Anyhow, though, they have a new sign up there at the Wilshire entrance. They may have one on the other entrance, too, but they have a new sign about how 100,000 people a day visit the Third Street Promenade. That's no village square. That's no town center. That's not Main Street. That is something totally different, actually. That's a gigantic mall, mass consumption for a mass society. And there's something a little bit scary about it because nobody knows each other. I mean, the people at Hennessy and Ingalls were one of the few relics of sort of a stable business there where, and also the Interactive Cafe. I mean, those people have been there for a long time. But those two at the outer edges of the Third Street Promenade, everybody else, I mean, the people who work in all those restaurants on the Third Street Promenade right now, the people who work in all the stores, I mean, they come and go. They're totally fungible. There is no community created.
I've also noticed, like, in my lifetime, I mean, also the demographics of the promenade have changed. I remember even when I was, like, 18, there was always like, packed with, like, lots of good-looking, like, teenage white girls.
And, you know, well, I mean, the racial transformation of Los Angeles is overwhelming. Los Angeles, Dallas, Houston used to be white cities. Phoenix, Arizona used to be a white city. But basically whiteness is vanishing in the United States. And, you know, only our friends, like Bill Johnson and the folks at the IHR are even remotely willing to talk about it, because the mainstream media basically says, as a matter of fact and with great enthusiasm, that white America is dying, and that the demographic change is natural, and that it is not part of a natural process, that, you know, that white America is over. I mean, they say that over and over again in the mainstream media.
With demographics, that's actually interesting, is we're seeing kind of a reversal. Is a lot of young white people are moving back into the urban core, and then the suburbs are becoming more diverse.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, do you have that statistically? I hadn't heard anyone say that. Is that a fact, or is that just an impression of yours? I mean, where do you get that?
No, I've seen statistics, like a lot of young white people who want, like, a more urban experience, like the hipsters are moving into places like downtown L.A., Hollywood, even Oakland. And then the suburbs are becoming much more diverse. Like, Orange County was, like, Orange County was, like, 90% white in the 1980s, and now Orange County is 40% white. So you're seeing kind of a reversal. And
isn't that amazing?
That's actually true in Paris as well. In Paris, you have the urban core of the city is very wealthy and mostly French, and then the suburbs are heavily poor and full of Muslim and African immigrants.
Yeah, I mean, of course, Paris is certainly much more spectacular that way. It's always been that way. The core of Paris has always been.
The thing is, what I was kind of touching on is I see your point about owning a single-family home, but, I mean, core of Paris is denser than New York even, and people there live in very small apartments. So people sacrifice their personal space to live in a place like that, even if they have to live in a small apartment. But that's more for single people. I think when people have families, they want to move out and have a single-family home. But
don't you think that fewer and fewer people are even forming traditional families these days?
Not so much.
It's Tate, you've never had the pleasure, honor of being married to a hot cheerleader who decides to take you for everything you're worth. but it's sort of an increasing pattern in modern society that marriage is a form of slow suicide, again, because of government policy, because of allegedly democratic decisions that really attack the family, attack the stability of private property, and attack the institution of the home, which goes with the institution of the family which goes with a single family home. I mean, it's much more common for single parents to be comfortable living in apartments and condos than it is whole families. I mean, if you've got a whole family, never mind a multi-generational family, with, you know, grandparents, parents, and children, you can't have those in condominiums. Unless it's even a 5 or 6 bedroom condominium is almost by definition in Los Angeles a millionaire's luxury.
If you're Donald Trump, you can have like a penthouse with 20 rooms on the top of a skyscraper, but that's fantastic if you're Donald Trump, but not for the rest of us.
It's limited to basically the top 1% of the top 1%. We're talking about basically the top, what would that be, a 100,000th of the population?
I told you about my trip to Vegas. I mean, did you see that picture I took outside of my hotel room I posted on Facebook?
Okay, you think that's not San Francisco? What is it? I'm looking at it. I saw the slanting building, and I assumed that was the Trans-America building.
So we did a show about Las Vegas. I was in Las Vegas over the last winter break, and I stayed in like a hotel at the sort of, must have been like the 30th floor. I can kind of understand the appeal of that kind of living. I mean, the view, like I showed, Charles, you see the picture I took of the view out my hotel room. Get a view like that from a single family home?
No, you don't. But I mean, think about it. You know, you're single. You're single. I don't know if you've, you know, got a stable significant other or not. But if you did, you know, would you be able to have family gatherings in a place like that? Would it even be remotely feasible to have people come over for Christmas, New Year's, Thanksgiving, or anything else, or your birthday, I mean, or anybody's birthday? It would be a major challenge. That's the point. The institution of the family goes with certain institutions, architectural institutions, and certain settlement patterns. And we give up the stability of the family, we give up the stability of ownership, we make ourselves dependent. And this is what I'm really deeply concerned about, is I'm concerned about social dependence and how our lifestyle fosters dependence and it fosters lack of autonomy in a situation like that. Where is the complementarity? Where is the organic solidarity of society?
We are out of time, so I would like to thank Charles Lincoln for being on.
Great talking to you, Robert, as always.